Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Brock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. And we kicked off with Rocket from Def Leppard, followed by the Steve Gibbons Band and Mr. Jones. And that last track was the Asian Dub Foundation, Real Great Britain. And it sounds we've been having a bit of a taste of that in Nottingham today. Well, plans for this evening's show haven't gone exactly as intended, so what I'm hoping to do is host something of an impromptu discussion on the nature of government, because this is what is being visited upon us all. It seems to me that we know that the Irish government is not what it appears to be, but it certainly seems to me that all of the governments that we've got now are really not what they pretend to be at all. And one of the things that I took part in once I was at the Fire in the Mountain Festival was a bit of a forum on the state of things and how maybe we might consider giving artists place to go, taking over abandoned buildings and one thing and another. There was quite a lot of interesting discussion. But in the process, it kind of it veered its way into several sub-chats, if you like, about elections, about governments and about referendums. And it seemed to me that there is at least from my point of view, a considerable degree of misapprehension as to just exactly what all of these terms mean and what is actually going on when we have these referenda of one sort or another. And it reminded me of a YouTube I saw some time ago. I think it's now had somewhere over 5.5 million views. And when I first saw it, I found it most amusing. And it struck me before that the things that we find most funny are the most funny because they are closest to the truth. And when I listened to it again recently, I found that my feelings toward it had changed. I still find it quite amusing, but it has a mixture of fair comment and statements which I think are certainly worthy of discussion. So Uniquely has very kindly offered to join me a little bit later in the show to talk about this subject. Anybody else who wants to get in touch also about the things that come up in this particular bit of audio, it'd be really great to hear from you. I'm on Dr. Rock 2012 on Skype. That's dr.rock2012, if anybody wants to get in touch. It'd be great to have a few people in with their thoughts on this matter, because government is clearly one of the things that it's very big, but one way or the other, we do need to deal with it. We do need to find solutions to it, and hopefully we'll be talking about some of that later in the show. The first thing I'm going to do is play this particular clip. It's called Government Explained, and the YouTube channel is called Man Against the State. So you can hear that I think he's got the right sort of ideas, maybe, but also some of the ideas that come across in it are a bit strange. So I'm going to play that. After that, there'll be a tune whilst I call Lee in, and then we'll take it from there and see how it... Very strange. Got a flashing light there that I'm not used to seeing. Anyway, here you go. Hopefully also you could all let me know in the chat box what it sounds like, because we've had more of a reset here over the last week, and I'd just like to know that it's all working properly. In the meantime, here is Man Against the State.
No, not really. I wouldn't say politicians are known for being... Hey, an alien!
Yes, I've travelled across space to check on the progress of your species.
Cool. Shall I take you to our leader?
Your what?
Our leader, the guy in charge.
The guy in charge of what?
Well, in charge of everything.
You have one guy in charge of everything?
No, he's in charge of government.
What is government?
Well, government makes the rules for us. It tells us what we can do and what we can't do.
So is government really smart? They come up with wise rules for you to follow?
Well, mostly. But some of its rules are really stupid.
Do you disregard those rules?
No, we have to follow the rules, even if they are stupid or we disagree with them. Government punishes anyone who disobeys the rules.
So you are slaves to government?
No, 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 it's not like that at all. Government works for us, the people. It serves us. We're the boss.
It tells you what to do, and it punishes you with violence if you disobey it, and yet you're its boss?
Yeah.
But there are some things government does that you don't like.
Well, yeah, not everything government does is popular. Like spending on wars, for example.
What is a war?
It's when government basically spends the people's money on weapons and soldiers and then sends them over to the other side of the world to kill a bunch of people over there and destroy their country. I don't like it that government does this.
Well, I can see why you might not like that. Have you humans reached the stage where you generally consider stealing, enslaving, and killing each other to be bad things?
Oh yeah, we know that. Don't steal, don't attack, don't assault.
But you give money to government and they use it to kill people.
Well, yeah. But government does good things with tax money as well.
Why don't you stop paying for the things you don't like and only pay for the good things it does?
No, we can't do that. You can't just decide to stop paying taxes because the rules say that everyone has to pay taxes.
But the rules come from government, though, don't they?
Yeah.
So government made a rule which says that everyone has to pay them money. So everyone pays taxes because if they didn't, government would punish them using violence?
Well, yes, but most people don't mind paying taxes. Most people feel obligated to pay taxes and obey government laws because it's for the good of society. Society needs government, and that means we all have to pay taxes.
So just to make sure I've got this straight, government makes the rules and you feel obligated to follow the rules, even the ones you don't like, and it tells you what to do and threatens to punish you if you don't do what it says, and it uses some of the money that it's taken from you using threats of violence to pay for things you don't like and actually think are immoral, like mass murder.
Yeah, but we can ask it to please tell us to do smart things, and please don't take our money and use it to kill people. We're allowed to ask them to tell us to do what we want them to tell us to do.
Are you guys just scared of this thing? Is government some huge monster that can just squish you at any moment if you disobey?
No, government isn't a monster.
Well, what is it then? Could you draw me a picture of it?
Government isn't really the sort of thing you can draw a picture of.
Maybe you could take me to it. Where is government?
You mean the building?
Government is a building.
No, but the politicians who make up the government have buildings they work from.
So government is a group of these politicians?
Yeah.
Okay, so what species are these politicians?
Well, they're human.
Like you?
Yeah.
So politicians are humans and they're government. You're a human, but you're not government.
No.
So it's the politicians, they're the ones that boss the rest of you around and make you do things you don't want to do and take your money using threats of violence. But even though you're all humans, you're not allowed to boss them around and take their money?
No, they'd put us in a cage if we did that. But look, it's not like the politicians can just do whatever they want. Like, a politician can't just come up to me on the street and make me give him money. They can't do that. Politicians can only do things like that in their job, when they're working for government.
Oh, so politicians aren't government, they just work for government.
Yeah.
Okay, so government isn't a monster, and it isn't a building, and it's not politicians, it's something else. And it employs politicians, who are just regular humans, who get to order everyone else around and take their money. How does a regular human become a politician?
Well, that's the great thing about our government. It's a democracy, and that means that the people actually have the power, because we get to decide who among us get to be the politicians. We get to vote. And if a politician starts doing things we don't like, we can just replace him with someone else at the next election.
So the people that get chosen to be politicians only get to boss people around and take their money for a short time, and then they go back to being regular humans?
Exactly.
That sounds like a powerful position to be in. But if you get to choose who does that, I assume that politicians are always the wisest, most honest, caring and respected people among you.
Well, no, not really. I wouldn't say politicians are known for being honest, or wise, or caring. And they're certainly not the most respected people among us. Come to think of it, most politicians are lying, power-hungry crooks.
The ones you chose?
Yeah, they're always doing things we don't like. They use taxpayers' money to enrich themselves and their friends, and they never keep their promises to voters. They've been caught stealing and lying and taking bribes, and they mostly do what the big corporations want. Yeah, they're always doing stuff like that. They're completely corrupt. They're a bunch of lying crooks.
But you said that most humans know that stealing and beating each other up and killing are wrong. And you said that you have the power because you can change who's in charge. So why don't you just replace the lying, thieving, murderous, crooked politicians with some regular people?
Well, we don't try to elect lying crooks. It just always turns out that way. But we have to have a government because some humans are nasty and might kill or enslave or steal. Civilization just couldn't survive without government.
Let me get this straight. Because you're worried about the small number of nasty people that are willing to kill, enslave and steal, you think it's necessary for your survival to have a system where some humans among you, for a short while, get to call themselves the government, and they get to order everyone else around like slaves and, if they want, commit mass murder overseas, using money they stole using threats of violence. Politicians get to kill, enslave and steal, because if they didn't, someone else might? And you try to elect good, honest people to be politicians, but what happens every time is that the people you elect turn out to be corrupt, evil, lying crooks. That's your system.
Yeah, that's pretty much government.
There we go, Johnny Cash there, and When the Man Comes Around, and let's face it, the man seems to be coming around ever more often, doesn't he, Lee?
He certainly does.
Thanks a lot for joining me, mate. I really do appreciate it for a bit of an impromptu chat on the subject of government, which is now pretty much an all-encompassing subject. I thought it was quite interesting that that video started with the idea of an alien species coming across space to check on the progress of our species. How long do you think it is since we've made any progress?
It reminded me of a Lark and Rose one, where he goes to the volcano gods, and he's trying to explain to them, well, you know, is that right? Just because, you know, it's a kind of ritual thing, is it right to throw other people into a volcano? It's like, oh, I've been doing it forever. You know, it's our culture, it's our nature, and the aliens going, but you're murdering people. it's the same outrageous kind of hypocrisy of it all.
Which is one of the things that came up again and again in that little bit of audio, wasn't it? Was that one of the things that our tax money, and I'm sure that we'll get round to tax in a bit, one of the things that it is most obviously, apparently at least, spent on, is on waging war in places far away from here. And We all know that it's wrong to kill people. It's been a basic understanding that causing harm of any sort, let alone killing people, it's been known to us for a long time, and yet somehow we seem to be approving it just by continuing to offer our votes to these people, which is it's been a mystery to me for a long time, but it becomes ever more so as I discover more about what's going on. And I mean, you know, I find myself wondering, you know, the Catholics condemned the Aztecs and the Maya and stuff for what they were doing, and yet we're not really, it seems to me, doing any better.
Well, the thing is, I mean, are we actually in control of our own lawmaking anyway, as regards to what we think are norms and civilized behavior anyway, when we look to government or so-called government? I mean, you're supposed to put these people in who are supposed to express your will and your intent. So if the projection that they're throwing out across the world and across the, you know, the intercontinents is that this government likes to perpetuate war everywhere, then the people need to reflect that. So I'm assuming that people will be gladly accepting that they are funding this thing, unless they truly don't understand government and how it operates. I mean, what would you say to that?
Well, that is a considerable level of understanding, but misunderstanding. But it does seem to me that that somehow people do disassociate the activities of government from their own votes. And I mean, let's face it, they are actually probably pretty well disassociated. But in a way, by turning up at the voting booth and putting your cross on a piece of paper, you are in a way approving of what's going on. It's one of the reasons why I stopped voting, basically, which was a long time before I discovered people's internet radio or its forerunners, because I recognised that I was being part of it and didn't want to be, and I've just wandered as time has gone along. I've just wandered further and further away from it, and it's why now I think that I'm on here doing this, is because I feel it's absolutely necessary to try and bring this, if you like, to the fore, and, you know, work hard on it with people that I meet and things. But it is amazing how switched off they are from the consequences of that particular action.
When you look historically at voting in general, I mean, it's only a really modern concept when you think about it. It's only a 1900th kind of thing, isn't it, that we've done pretty much since the Industrial Revolution, when women got rights and the whole domestication of Britain, or England, however you want to call this, this appellation of what we live on, the soil. It's only been this century that everything's pretty much changed when it comes to voting and all of these rights. So where did we go wrong in the, I don't know, the latter half of last century? I would look back to our parents' generation.
I mean, did we have governments before we all started voting? I guess it was just the landowners that were voting to start with, wasn't it?
It would appear to me, because when I was chatting with my dad about this years ago, he was of the impression that British people, or English people in general, didn't even have an education until the 1920s, because they were always forever outcrying and saying to government, any chance you could educate us so we can read some of these pieces of legislation you keep passing? So it took them ages to even get grammar schools, or what they used to call them, comprehensives. So that's only really been grandfathers and great-grandfathers' time periods when they were even getting an education, never mind understanding the system they were under and then putting an X on a piece of paper. I mean, they didn't have a clue any more than we're just starting to realise now. I mean, we've got 80 years to catch up on, but we're getting there quickly.
Yes, I think we are. I think we are. And presumably more and more people are starting to realise just exactly what it is that's sitting above them. And I mean, the actual nature of government itself seems to be a bit of a mystery, in that it's certainly believed that the politicians for whom we apparently vote, I'm not even sure that the votes that are being cast are the ones that are being counted anymore, but the idea is that the people for whom we apparently vote are kind of in charge, like the alien said, you know, the guy that was talking to him said, you know, the leader is the guy that's in charge of everything, of government. But, you know, that's not exactly the case, is it?
Not quite, because they are in office to be technical. Even though it's a manufactured legal construct, they are in this ecclesiastical place, this space they create called an office. And we still have the right and the absolute inalienable capacity to evict them from their office when they're obviously misconducting it. Something else we've learned over the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, that misconduct is still a natural law that is still enforceable. Especially it's, when it's the people.
It's still extremely difficult to pin it on them, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't so much happen in the national press, as far as I can tell, but certainly in private eye, they've been writing about thievery and skullduggery and paedophilia and all manner of other things for 30 years, as far as I can remember.
Yeah.
And yet nothing ever seems to happen about it, and still nothing's happening. I mean, it's almost like these people are kind of get some sort of immunity.
It seems that way, but on one level you can kind of see the mind control just taking over most people because they're all deluded about a lot of things. And then on the other side, you've got the likes of us who are trying to just point people in the right direction to think, you know, ask yourself a question. These people represent you and your will and your intent. The shadow you're casting around the world is something of a warmonger. Is that really what you want to pass to your children?
Yes,
and question.
Something we've been doing for a very, very long time. And of course, there's also the matter to be considered that actually there is a huge machine behind all of this. There's basically a massive, full-time, well-paid bureaucracy which stays in place irrespective of who it is that people are voting for.
Yeah. And as Pat Velden says there, people never voted. Persons voted. And he's absolutely right. The whole act of registration should be a big clue for you.
Yeah, as should the fact that they're extremely keen for you to register your vote, but they don't seem to really give a toss whether you use it or not.
Yeah. One thing I found with their registration is, again, it's an offer. They'll give you all kinds of strange veiled threats, like if you don't and if you don't do this. But if they use the magical return to sender, you don't hear from them again.
Mm.
You don't.
I've found registration actually quite a useful subject to discuss with people. It is one that seems to knock home, because you can point to the registration documents for their vehicle and say, look, it says you're the registered keeper, not the owner. And so the idea that that registration is the handing over of superior rights of guardianship or title can actually be demonstrated. And I've been particularly struck by that, because that piece of official paper with those particular words on it does seem to bring the message home. And I'm wondering whether it might be a technique we might find other places to use. Also, I've been struck in Wales, certainly in Powys, the county council has been trying to encourage people to register their cesspits, because a lot of people are off the mains out here. And interestingly, most of the people I know are simply throwing those bits of paper away. They are, if you like, refusing to register. So I'm wondering whether there isn't maybe a kind of instinct arising in people now. And that's another one that might be used to kind of bring home to people just exactly what it is that's going on.
I think what's beautiful as well is when you use simple things like your driving license, it hits home to people, because that generally is their pride and joy in this miserable world we live in at the moment. It's the car, isn't it? They wash it over Sunday. It's part of the family. But if you suddenly turn around to them and say, by the way, you know that legal right that the adverts tell you that they can crush your car? Well, do you know how they got that right? And then explain them. Well, you gave it to them by registering it. And then their eyes all go all shiny and suddenly they're interested. But up until that point when you describe them crushing the car, they're not interested.
No, indeed, or until
they have. You have to give them an image of crushing their beloved car to get the point through.
That is a good one. But again, you know, there seems to be a bit of a slide response when it comes to these things, that the basic thought process seems to be, well, they must have seized the car and crushed it because he's an evil guy, or he's, I don't know, done whatever it is, and I don't do those things, therefore they won't seize and crush my car. But, you know, I had that ex-Metropolitan police officer on the show once who made it quite clear that he had 50 traffic officers working for him, and that each one of them was expected to seize one machine a week. So yeah, between them, they were going to be seized. Their targets were to seize 200 machines, and that was more or less irrespective of whether these people were or were not stepping outside what were perceived to be the legislative bounds. And that was an important point, I think. You know, that's 200 cars a month. It's going to be 2,400 a year or whatever it is. It's an enormous number of machines that are going to be seized and actually crushed. Or, you know, if it's a nice motor, they'll actually sell it on, won't they?
Isn't it funny they crush it up into a cube? Just thought I'd throw that in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is that is government actually there to make rules for everybody, which is another statement that was made in the little audio. My original impression when I was younger was that government was there to facilitate the activities of the people, and stuff like that, not actually there to make rules. But we've got more and more rules, and certainly more and more government over the years. It's really quite stunning how government is proliferating around the place. I mean, again, in Powys, we've got the council appear to be everywhere now. They've got a massive Victorian hotel that they occupy. They've got a fairly new, I think it's a couple of decades old, purpose-built building. They've been giving grants to landlords to do their houses up, and all of those are made into flats, which are then kind of let out. But underneath, at the bottom, on the kind of on the roadside, as it were, there's loads more council officers with the windows whited out, saying that they're not a customer-facing department and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, then, of course, we got ourselves a Welsh Assembly a few years back, because 49.5% of us apparently voted against it and 50.5% voted for it. There's barely even a majority there. And then it extends out to Europe, and just exactly how much influence the Muppets that get voted in on a general selection campaign here, just exactly how much influence they have anymore on what's going on is, I think, highly questionable now. And there's hundreds of them, and they're really expensive.
What's always puzzled me, right, is going kind of back to the beginning of where law came from and this idea of governance. If we go, you know, all the way back to those 10, you know, what they call the Decalogue, those 10 commandments are kind of like the first 10 laws, aren't they? The first rules of man. Unlike the hundreds of thousands of codes and little regulations that we have now, where you have to wear a certain thing to go to a certain place at a certain time and do a certain thing. But once upon a time, we just had 10 rules, and I'll be honest, 7 of those you can get rid of because they all relate to family and a civil system. Only 3 of them really exist under what you call a natural law. You know, don't steal, don't murder, and honour your mother and father.
And of those 3, 2 of them are more or less disregarded as a matter of standard practice by most governments in most places, I'd say. The stealing and killing seems to be something that they're actually pretty good at motivating people to do.
Yeah, and they've always been harsh on those 2, even historically when you go back to like 2000 BC or 2500 BC. You've got laws there which are expressly, you are dying if you commit murder or theft. Because back then, remember, they weren't stealing from people's houses. They were stealing from temples. We don't treat our houses like temples, do we? We get security alarm systems and we lock ourselves in.
Yeah.
And we give all our money to the big temple. the temple in London.
Well, yeah, indeed, which of course lies behind the government. But I mean, I've heard it said, and I think it's a fair enough comment, that we give as much stuff to the government nowadays as people used to give to the temple in the old days, and you know, your belief somehow that your vote is not implicating you in all of this murder and theft around the place is pretty similar, it seems to me, to any belief that states that, you know, some guy can have himself nailed to a cross a couple of thousand years ago and the rest of us don't need to worry. It practically is a religious commitment, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we are still in this kind of biblical cult age where instead of taking, you know, what we had as a system, we've took a paper god and paper idols, and we think they're worth something. And we've based our entire, I don't know, existence upon paper. Paper receipts.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, do we even get that far when, if we go back in time, the three things that we've just mentioned, you know, don't steal, don't, you know, murder people, obviously, and honor your mother and father. You know, those principles are completely gone when you look at today's world. Completely gone. Mm. And yet you've got Christians saying, well, I'm this and I'm that. Well, why don't you follow the simple 10? And why do you need to suddenly latch onto the United Nations human rights nonsense for protection? Why don't you just follow the 10 laws that you've got? Why do you need hundreds of thousands of codes and hundreds of thousands of pieces of legislation when you've got 10 rules and three of them really only apply? The other seven, if depends on if you live in a married, civilized system, which again conjures the question, how old is this stuff? You know, you look at the Code of Urukina, 2250 BC. All of these things are there already. Civil systems, penalties, what's deemed good and bad. A bit like Brecon Law. When you look at the Brecon Law system, it's very similar to that. You know, it's all about debt inequality and trying to rectify it when the rich overconquer the poor with debt. They always have jubilees to offset the indebtedness and free the people. But I don't see the system doing that anymore.
Well, it's doing quite the opposite, isn't it? I mean, certainly when I was younger, it was definitely the case that people were actually encouraged to save and make sure. I mean, okay, look, you know, they were saving fake money, meaningless promissory tokens, as it were. But at least they were being encouraged to save these imaginary things and then go out and get stuff when they had the kind of apparent resource to do it. And at some stage, it turned to the point where credit was a good thing, where your credit rating is, I mean, you know, next to your car, probably your credit rating is the next most valuable thing to a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole thing with most of the ancient law is it's all about land. You know, it's returning you to your land when someone else has tried to seize it, which is usually a bad dictator stroke king. And then you got different king reformers come in and say, hang on a minute, you can stay out of that. No more ecclesiastical getting involved in property robbing. You know, he kind of reformed the whole system, but it wasn't authoritarian. But somehow we've kind of edged back to an older system that doesn't belong here. You know, it's crept back in.
Well, I mean, the question as to how old all of this stuff is, I think is a very interesting one, because the Saxons apparently kind of instituted a lot of the kind of legal mores that we've got now, and the Normans came here and looked upon them and saw that they were good, and they assumed they kept pretty much all of those running, and then seemed to have been just adding to them ever since. So fundamentally there doesn't seem to me to have been any change round here for, well, you know, possibly since the Romans, possibly since a long time before that. I'm still wondering just exactly when the Brehon Law was actually current. Do you know when it was actually, when it was running as written in these islands?
As an Englishman, when I first heard of Brehon Law, when Vin was talking about it, I had no idea. I'd never even heard of it.
No, me nope. neither. Me neither.
No. Pretty much flushed down the toilet of a history where we are. Never heard of it before. We know about the Domesday Book in 1066, and everything after 1066 we know about. But if you want to go back a little bit earlier, oh, it's a bit murky. You know, you got Alfred the Great and the Vikings, but before that, you know, the 8th century to the 4th century in England, not much there.
No.
Not much.
And before that, even less, of course.
Yeah. So we've got about 1,000 years worth of history to contemplate of actually where all this stuff came from. But when we look into history, we see some of the remnants of some of these good highly advanced civilized systems where on one level you could call them a benevolent dictator for one point of reference. On another side, you could have an absolute dictator which crushed the people using debt by the upper classes. And then a new king came in and reset it all and put everything on a level playing field, and hence they bring the goddess into it, you know, the whole liberty thing. You got to rebalance the scales here. So there's always been reformations of people abusing power. So again, cycles repeat, I would say. We're definitely in one of those repeating cycles. Although yeah.
And of course, in this kind of process, the real wealth inevitably ends up time and again in a very small number of hands, because if everybody's believing in the whatever the money system is, I suspect it's probably always been a form of fraud.
Yeah.
If you can actually get enough of that stuff into your pockets and then convert it into real things, especially into things like land and buildings and possibly even influence over people, then you do end up with all of the real wealth concentrated in a very, very small space. But I mean, at the moment, that the gap between the richest and the poorest is getting ever bigger, and the rich are getting just unbelievably rich.
Yeah, I think you'll see the first trillionaire this year.
The first
trillionaire.
I've been I had a book kind of forced into my hands recently by Robert Peston, who I think is Babylon Broadcasting's chief economic correspondent or something.
He's a common purpose supporter as well. He speaks at House quite often.
Yes, and like all economic correspondents, I can never really tell whether they know what's going on and they're not telling us, or whether they genuinely don't know what's going on. So with me, it's just a question of whether they're a patsy or a fraud, really.
He knows. Mr. Peston knows exactly what's going on.
Yeah, I think you're right. And what I did with this book, it's called Who Runs Britain? But it should actually have been called Who Ruins Britain? And, I read the first chapter and the last chapter of it, and I thought, yeah, okay, I'll give this a go. And actually, it is a bit of an education for me. I didn't really know too much about how private equity operates or how hedge funds operate.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a pretty good job of explaining all of that, and how vast amounts of money are basically now being pocketed by single individuals rather than by, say, pension funds or whatever. Excuse me. But at the same time, knowing what we know about money, knowing what we know about the Bank of England, and all the rest of it, he's very clever at running a line which suggests that, you know, he does obviously know quite a lot, but he has to say, every now and then he says things like, you know, if there were to be a recession. And I'm thinking, well, you must know as much as I do, mate, that that is an absolute inevitability. In fact, recession is just not going to describe what's about to happen to us.
He was talking about Greece the other day, and again, a lot of cryptic came out of his gob. He does cryptic quite a lot. Yeah, he hedges his bets, because on one thing, he'll ask the question, and if it happens, it gives him credence. So he'll probably know, but he'll do it in a way, he'll phrase it as a question to himself or a question to the audience, knowing fully well he knows the answer to it, but he'll throw it out there and say, oh, see, if. And then it happens, and you go, oh, Robin was right.
And clever. Do you think we've got any honest economists working in this system who are actually telling it as it is?
Economists, I don't know, but you've got a few writers. Like Daniel Hannan's an interesting guy. Have you heard of he's kind of like a... I can't think of the other guy's name. He's Owen something. He's a young lad, but every time you hear him, he's like a young Nigel Farage. You're kind of convinced that he knows what he's on about, but you just still don't trust him. I can't think of his name. He's a young lad. He's always on Question Time. Says a lot of the right things, but I just can't trust any of them anymore. I can't.
No, I know what you mean. It's getting to the point where it's very difficult to trust what comes from anybody, and it's also, I think, getting more and more difficult to tell. I just feel that the more I get to know, the less I feel I actually know.
I know how to, and I know how this system can be brought down quite safely, but it's going to need the will of the people to do it, because they're going to have to appreciate why they're going to have to do it. And that would be take all your money out of the bank. expose them for what they've got, and then address it when it comes. Because once you expose them, they can only offer so many answers to a question that's the right one.
Which is, of course, exactly why they shut the banks in Greece.
Exactly that. Exactly.
I saw a shot the other day of a bank in Greece with these huge black steel shutters that, you know, I suspect you'd find it very difficult to get through. And in front of it was a row of riot police.
Yeah.
So they obviously are. It did imply to me when I saw that picture, I thought, God, these guys really are desperate to make sure that the banks don't get emptied. And perhaps you've just put your finger on why that's the case.
Yeah. I think that Syriza's guy, the Prime Minister, he gave the people a bit of a time window as if to say, get your money out the bank because I can't hold them off much longer. I've got to do a midnight deal. It gave them time. But did you notice the following day, as soon as he gave them a lifeline, they closed the banks on them?
Yeah, exactly right. And I think that probably...
trying to do for them, but they snapped them straight away.
Yeah, and it probably cuts both ways, that does, doesn't it? Because by shutting the banks, by limiting what's available out of the hole-in-the-wall machines, what you're effectively doing is putting the gun more immediately to the heads of individual Greeks than saying, you know, look, okay, if you've got away with your 60 euros and now the machine is empty, you've now got to live on that 60 euros for a week. And this is what it's going to be like if you don't accept the next bailout.
See, this is what the new Roman Empire does. It doesn't encamp around your town anymore and starve you to death, you know, by denying you food coming into your town. What they do now is they steal your money so you can't buy food. It's Roman. It's still the Roman system. They just do it differently these days. They wall you in, but all your money's in the bank and they wall you out of your bank so you can't get access to it.
And it happens incredibly quickly.
Very quickly.
And, you know, it's something that I guess we've been kind of... Well, I mean, personally, I'm amazed that it's kind of run on 10 years beyond when I thought it was all going to go tits up. I'm amazed that they've managed to spin it along the way they have. But still, the vast majority of people do not recognise that interest and the paper money and all of that have absolutely, definitely and without a doubt built into them the utter and complete collapse of the whole system. They're completely unprepared for it. It's going to come as a hell of a shock. And also, I mean, I still hear people saying quite regularly that, you know, that the Greeks are work shy, that they're lazy, that they don't pay their taxes, and that's why they're in the state that they're in.
And that justifies it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That justifies it somehow.
Well, again, there's no evidence anymore of the thought of, you know, any kind of empathy at all for another human being who's in trouble. It's just that, you know, it's the same over here. You know, if people are seen with a policeman or a bailiff or something like that, then no matter how well people know them, those people are going to assume that the individual who is the focus of this attention has done something wrong. It's almost an automatic response.
What I find more perverse is you have government saying to people who are thinking about journeying over there, make sure you got enough money. Because although that land's slipping, you know, like Atlantis into the sea, just make sure you got enough cash because they haven't got any. Okay?
Mm.
And I'm sitting there going, you've got the audacity to tell people that while they're in complete hardship. And then the next thing they come out with is, oh, make sure you got a hell of a lot more money because the cash machines aren't working either. All electronic funding machines aren't working. And you might have to, you know, purchase some security because you might get mugged because there's lots of desperate, hungry people over there.
Mm.
And perhaps, I'm just, this media shaking my head.
Yeah, Pat's just put into the chat box, money is secondary to the real theft that's in progress. Because in this process, the Greek people are losing their parks, their beaches, their... All of the resource that they believe to be theirs is ending up in the hands of foreign corporations. And again, what's going on with the money is really just a distraction. It keeps people from paying attention to any of that.
Yeah. I think that's what that big Tunisian thing was about. It was a big smokescreen. You know, look at the Tunisian guy on the beach and the other two events. You know, they all come in threes. You look at all that stuff while we rob Greece.
Yeah.
You keep looking at all that ISIS stuff and we'll just concentrate on doing Greece a little bit more while you're not watching. But do book your holidays. No, it is hot.
And this, you know, the thing is that the the people who are getting voted in, and again, we'll ignore for the moment the fact that a lot of these decisions are made by non-elected commissioners of one sort or another.
Yeah.
But somehow the governments that are voted in, or at least nominally voted in all over Europe, claiming that they're going to do this, that and the other, nobody's actually pointing a finger at the governments generally or Europe generally and saying, look, you know, we, in theory, put you in charge to make the best decisions for us and for our people. And yet, here we've got a European nation that is way beyond the brink of collapse. We've got people setting fire to tyres in Calais and all the rest of it because there's so many people trying to get out of where they are and into other places. Where is the control? Where is the administration? Where is the stability that, you know, we pay you to produce? Again, it's just amazing that it doesn't, that question never seems to arise in the mainstream, is how come this is all going so badly wrong? And when I talk to people about it, you know, I know people who are, they're historians, so they know a lot about military history as it is in the books.
Yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. And they honestly get really excited when you start suggesting that this might be being done with some intent, that it is systemic, it is built into the system. Because what they believe is they believe in cock-up rather than conspiracy. They believe that we have just genuinely been totally crap at running things for 2,000 years and that somehow we continue to be crap, despite all of our technology and all of our knowledge and whatever gods we might or might not have and whatever wisdom was drawn together by our ancestors, they seem to think that we are just incapable, just not competent of doing a proper job, which I don't think is the case. Do you?
One thing I've kind of come to realise and accept is this system, as artificial as it is, has complete disdain for you and me. They're not interested in particularly talking to you or I. They want to talk to a piece of paper and treat it like some product. Some kind of receipt for payments of some kind. They don't really see us as flesh and blood.
Well, they give us a receipt for our arrival, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, Vince said it once. I mean, they have complete disdain for humans. This artificial system that all these bankers and these so-called titles, these office holders hold, they're not interested in us. They're interested in the paper cut. It's also interested in that figure in the bank account, which I'm sure shortly will be raided from their account too, because they're not safe from any of this.
No, quite so. Quite so. And yeah, I think disdain is absolutely the word. I mean, one of the things the man said to the alien in the video was that government comes up with mostly wise rules. Well, another reason why I wanted to cease having anything to do with them was because I realised that basically, as far as I could remember, they'd never actually done anything of which I could wholeheartedly approve. That it was the people around me who seemed to be generous, empathetic, friendly, helpful, supportive, all of that. I'd never seen any evidence of any government actually doing that. They sometimes claim that they're going to be in the manifesto and stuff. But as for actually realising any of that once they've been voted in, it just, as far as I can see, it just never happens.
Well, I have a problem with manifesto. I mean, I took a little talk out, well, 5 years ago, and I looked at the word manifesto, and I said to the people, OK, you're going to go out and vote, apparently, for one of three candidates. You've got, you know, this Miliband guy or whoever it was at the time. You've got three contracts being offered to you. Three of them have got this brochure of all the rules and regulations that you as a citizen, if you adopt that status and you wish to vote, that contract is going to apply to you, your person, your shadow self. Now, what they don't realise is a manifesto is an international binding written document which declares interests in warfare. That's what it says. Usually promulgated by a prince or an executive branch of government.
Oh, is that what a manifesto is? That's a new one on me. You learn something new every day, eh?
It's actually a war funding document. That's why it's a budget. That's why they're all rationed. Because there's war to fight. That's what a manifesto is. So I said to people, when you go out and vote, just know what you're handing over when someone's saying, do you want to look at our manifesto? That's a war document. That's how much you're going to fund for war. That's why I didn't vote, and that's why I don't register. Mm. Why would I be part of a Roman system that does things like that? Why would I vote for that?
And that is what taxes were originally raised for, wasn't it? Was for fighting wars.
Again, crusades, you know, we're in a holy war still. We've got jihadis and ISIS, you know, jihadi John, ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, whatever this new word the government's trying to label the whole amalgamation of all of these funded groups, which all pretty much have the same goal, you know, annex the whole of the United Arab States and make it one big Arabic nation under Muslim, you know, under Islam. That's becoming quite very clear what that is. So we're in a crusade still. I don't think the crusades have ever ended, nor has Rome ever ended. We're still in the same thing, same empire.
And the people who are running the money machines are basically funding both sides and, I suspect, training and arming both sides as well.
Yeah. To give the illusion of this big last end script of this book they call the Bible, you know, it's a script. They're trying to enact or reenact the same ending by putting two sides against each other and having this Armageddon idea. Now, I don't particularly want the end of that book because it's crap. It's a crap ending. You know, but they're going to try and play that out and make it manifest. And I don't want that.
Yeah, and I mean, it does look, it is amazing how much like the kind of stuff that's written about in Revelation it all looks. I mean, the business of people waking up and... say just taking all their money out of the banks, that would certainly sock it to the people, to only to a certain extent. I think that again Pat's really put his finger on the trigger, as it were, with the whole legal thing. It's dependent on paper talking to dead entity persons. If people, because again, something that was said in the little audio we said was, we have to follow the rules, even if they are stupid or we disagree with them. Well, fundamentally, I think you're absolutely right. Stop paying, stop funding it is a really crucial thing. But the most important thing is that we realise that that if everybody refused to follow the rules and started following the proper rules, which is not stealing, not stealing, not killing, honouring your father and mother, and actually to stick with that and not fund people who show themselves to be dishonest and who show themselves to be involved in such things, then the world would change pretty quickly. It's still one of my major hopes that there is going to be a kind of... an outbreak of civil peace, you know, rather than civil war, that people are suddenly going to realise.
There's no vaccine for that either. I hope not, anyway.
There's what?
There's no vaccine for that one. That's incurable.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, it's like Rob Freeman said once. He said to me, you know, if everybody woke up and said, if it's not right, I'm not going to do it. If it's not true, I'm not going to say it.
Yeah.
Because these... I have a suspicion that the way government behaves, it is kind of setting a kind of example, which is then echoing its way all the way down through society. And people say to me, people are basically evil and irresponsible. And to a certain extent, you kind of see that in that. I remember reading that when a certain local council, I can't remember which one it was, decided that it was no longer going to do the parking control thing, and it withdrew its traffic wardens, and for a couple of years there were no traffic wardens, there were no guys in the peak caps or whatever wandering around telling you where you could and couldn't park. And at that stage, a certain proportion of the population literally started parking in rose beds, and they started parking on double yellow lines by traffic lights, and then they started double parking each other onto double yellow lines and things like that. Now, I'm still pretty convinced that most people don't behave that way, and that it would be really good if we could find a way of sorting it out which didn't involve men in Thunderbirds uniforms coming along. But the overall effect was that when somebody did come along, when a private contractor was finally booked to come in a couple of years down the line and start doing this work again, people were massively grateful. But it's only because people as a whole hadn't taken responsibility and sorted it out for themselves. They somehow felt that it was necessary to leave it running wild whilst there was no perceived authority to prevent it from doing so. But of course, if people were to step into their own authority and start looking at these kind of things and working their way around it, we might be starting to make a little bit of progress.
I think going back to your mother and honour your mother and thy father, the big problem we've got with that one, as an old adage, is the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child destroyed that. Because you don't honour your mother and your father when they give the child the right to take their own parents to court. They give them the right to do that, a wonderful privilege under the United Nations human trafficking system. But I thought to myself, you're in a sovereign people, you know, we're here talking about sovereignty and taking responsibility, and I don't know why Ireland voted that in. I'm still perplexed how you got that in, because it's so dangerous. It's so dangerous. You know, it basically legalises child adoptions and forced kidnappings. I mean, it's clearly written. I don't see how it got passed. And if it has been passed, why isn't it then now repealed or being asked to be repealed or someone cancel it? Because it's dangerous. It's the linchpin. It's kind of the rainbow bridge to all the other nasty things that generates. It opens all the doors, you know, to the child protection services, the NHS, the hospitals, the school system. It all intertwines and interlaces through that treaty or that convention. And it needs to be repealed.
As do a lot of them. I mean, a lot of these things appear in the words, well, again, I'm not sure. It's not quite the same once you read the actual documents themselves, but the kind of gloss that's put on them when you read about them in the newspapers or hear about them on the current affairs shows is that they're going to be good for you, whereas in fact they're not. And I mean, the thing that really brought that home to me was when I heard about how the Australian government were offering to basically give land back to the Aborigines and said, you know, if you register, you just sign here and you can have your land back. Whereas, of course, yeah, yeah. They'd never lost their land in the first place. And by doing the registration, they were actually giving it away. And the thing is that was an example that if it kind of shattered for me layers of obscurity on legislation and these especially treaties and charters and the like, because once you've seen that happen once and you kind of grokked it and you know it and understand the mechanics of it, then it makes it a lot easier to run that. It makes it a lot harder to run that sort of thing past you again.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I would say, I mean, I used to have a Facebook page years ago called Repeal the United Nations, you know, repeal membership to it. And the reason why I've done that is I studied it for years. You know, I'm not one of these guys that watches YouTube videos about it. I actually read all the documents, tracked a lot of the security resolutions, you know, where they have the Security Council resolutions, went through a lot of that stuff, and you realize the whole thing is about human trafficking and disaster management systems. It's not there to promote peace. In fact, it's completely the opposite. It's there to destroy families. That's its whole purpose.
My God, now, how long did it take you to? Because there's rakes of that stuff.
Oh, I had shed loads on my Facebook account before I threw all that down the bin when they brought out Timeline. It was like, bye-bye. No, that's recording my thoughts and everything now, so I got off it. So yeah. I don't exist, but I put so much up there for people to read and say, look what it is. Look what it's designed to do. Especially the first three meetings in the 60s and I think it was Paris and Israel or somewhere around there. I mean, it's clearly written there.
Mm.
You know, it's the nuclear family we're after.
Yeah. I think Pat's put another interesting point in the chat box there, just by the by, saying the people never passed it, Lee, the system did. Which, of course, is true, isn't it? Nobody got to vote on any of these documents.
Yeah. But the thing is, if it's in now, it still should be ejected back out. So that would maybe still be something to do. I know it's in now, it's obviously being forced in, but it can also be forced out.
Yes, but we we'd need to develop some techniques for doing that, wouldn't we? Because that's another thing I think that is deeply questionable about the system, is that, I mean, as well as the treaties and the charters and all the rest, you've got the legislation, which is just added year after year after year. So you kick off with tens and then hundreds, then thousands, then tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands of pieces of legislation and legislative instruments.
Yeah.
And not only are we not consulted on what's going to be brought in, there is, as far as I can see, no means of actually getting rid of any of it.
It's the assumption that whatever they write in some darkened room with a candle, with an owl looking over the shoulder, somehow whatever they write in these mysterious halls of residence, that they're going to just pop out and say, yeah, someone endorse this and make it a bill, so then we can charge everyone who's eligible for it. Okay, thanks. And then we all sit there like boneheads going, I've just got this request of some money or something. Someone's writ a bill. And we don't look at it and think, well, isn't that just the most preposterous thing in the world? That you can actually sit there and make this legislation and assume that I'm going to pay without asking me. And the very idea I pay you a wage to do it.
Yeah. Pay twice. Pay twice, pay three times, pay four times. Why don't you?
Yeah. I mean, you must think I'm insane to believe that system anyway, for a start. I mean, great, you may act all day and, you know, you may have a good title that you take home to your wife, but it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. I could do that all day. I could write some bills and, you know, get someone to stamp them and say, yeah, now you're eligible to pay me something. We can all do that, can't we?
Well, that's another major point, isn't it? That, you know, the alien said in the little bit of audio, it was going, so these guys are humans like you are, and they've got the right to demand money off you with threats of violence and force, and somehow you don't have the right to do that to them, which is another really great simple question that I sometimes see rather pulling the rug out from people's feet. Where does this power come from? You know, who? Yeah. And it is, it's really like, isn't it really like the superheroes in the Marvel and DC comics? It's like somebody's turning up wearing their underpants on the outside. And that's good enough to just fool us into giving them everything.
I mean, the other thing that I've kind of one thing to remind people is the United Nations has a charter. Now, a charter is a corporation. You know, it's granted by something else. When a charter is granted, it's getting its authority from somewhere else. But the point is, the United Nations is another company. And all they're doing is writing company policy for you employees of theirs. Oh, sorry, your world citizenship.
Yeah.
Because that's what they think you are, world citizens now.
Yeah, they didn't call it the UN for nothing either, did they? Because I noticed that every now and then we have an unhealth day and an unchild day and all of that.
All these ritualistic days they invent, Earth Day, you know, Slavery Day. I like that one.
Yeah.
Anti-Slavery Day, that's great.
And again, that's another interesting subject, is trying to talk to people about slavery and you know, saying, well, hang on a moment, if something like 80% of what you earn is being taken off you, and a substantial portion of what you spend with other people, because you're having to pay them for the fact that 80% of what they're earning is being taken off them, and you probably end up with less than an imaginary penny in the imaginary 100 pennies that you're actually getting. And then that every single penny that you're handing over is actually going to pay interest on a debt, being charged by a private corporation. Then surely that is slavery. You know, what else is it? If you're spending all your time out there doing something you don't want to do, to earn a load of stuff which is then taken off you, then that is slavery, isn't it?
You're suffering your own enslavement, really, yeah. Because it's voluntary servitude, in a way. They've got you kind of convinced that your own enslavement is actually normal. That this is how it's always been. Because your grandparents told you that, you know, it's always been like this, son. It's just the way it is.
Well, again, that is one that I hear also when, you know, running through the mortgage discussion with people, when I say, you know, you kind of create your 100 grand to buy a house, and then, you know, if you've got your 25-year mortgage at, say, 7%, they're going to take £240,000 off you. And the response I most commonly get when I'm involved in this discussion is eventually they just say, well, we've got that. That's the system we've got, and we've got to have a system. And you think, we just explained that even if the money was real, that what's happening here is you're exchanging a house. They're taking for say £100,000, and they're going to take 300 because they nick the 100 grand to start with. Then they take 240 off you, so they're taking £340,000 for a nominal £100,000 investment. And people genuinely don't seem to think, well, a lot of the people I talk to, in fact, nobody so far has actually stood back and gone, my God, that's disgusting. Nearly everybody has said, well, you know, we need to have a system, and that's the system we've got, all words to that effect, which is pretty shocking, really.
Well, I always find funny now and again when I have this conversation about property is, okay, you built a house and it cost, I don't know, 80 grand to build it at some point. 5 years down the line, it suddenly becomes worth double, 180 grand now. How did the brick gain value? It was made and cast at a certain price at a certain time, and it was cemented to the foundation at a certain, you know, point in the calendar year. 5 years later, how the hell can that not do anything else but depreciate? Because it's second-hand goods. Whoever takes possession of that now has taken second-hand bricks, second-hand mortar, second-hand beams, second-hand windows. How do they go up? They should be going down because things dilapidate. Things go into disrepair. Yeah. So, how are they doubling in value? There's something kooky going on, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah, and again, inflation, I realise, is something new as well. I'm not sure whether it came in with Keynesian economics or what, but I was reading the other day that there was a period of kind of 100 years, say, from 1820 to 1920 or something, when the same number of dollars would have brought you the same amount of bread in the United States, which meant that you could actually have been in a position to look at how much you were earning, how much work you were doing, how much time you were putting in, and you could have arranged to put aside enough of the imaginary tokens to actually and know what they were going to buy over the next 20 years. So the idea of a kind of retirement and having a bit of a store of these gaming tokens was actually more realistic. Whereas now, I mean, there have been times, I think, in my time here when inflation, as they call it, has been running at something like 14%, which means that prices are doubling every, what, 4 or 5 years, something like that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Which is really shocking. Look, I think we've earned ourselves a couple of tunes, don't you? I think we've earned a wee break and a couple of tunes, and I can go and lock the chickens up. And then we can come back. we can come back and have another go.
Yeah, I can make a brew. That sounds good.
Brilliant, excellent stuff. So I'm going to play a couple of tunes. You've been listening to Dr. Rock chatting with Lee, nominally about government, but ranging broadly across a number of subjects. And just for a bit of light relief, here's Ted Nugent and Wang Dang Sweet Poontang. Oh yeah, there you go. That was the. And Heartland, and there's not a lot of heart in the system that we're running at the moment, is there, mate?
Back heart, it is.
Yep. And these rules that the government make on our behalf, saying that we've got to pay taxes or be punished, well, we're not sure there is a rule for paying taxes, are we?
I've not found one yet.
Yeah, I recently rewatched Freedom to Fascism.
Oh yeah,
which is an absolutely fabulous movie, because I was trying to explain it to some American people that are staying here at the moment, and one of them straight away said, well, there was an amendment, wasn't there, saying that private people had to pay tax, the 16th Amendment. But I pointed out to them that there was tax attorneys, there was ex-employees of the Internal Revenue Service, which I gather is a London-based corporation anyway, and they were all saying that there is no, they were really quite emphatic, they were saying there is no law saying that, period, and the Supreme Court overruled the 16th Amendment, and therefore it is not a valid, not even a valid piece of legislation.
Yeah, but how many Americans know that?
According to that movie, something like 68 million of them are not filing tax returns. Just how many of them are going to continue to get away with it, of course, remains to be seen.
Well, America is in a kind of sticky pickle, this must be said, because they're very much under the United Nations control, sadly. That's why I've been calling it the United Nations of America for a while.
You're a funny man.
Oh, ex-America, that usually annoys people. Oh, you mean ex-America? Yeah, yeah. It did well for a while.
It did, but again, it seems to be managing, at least apparently, to keep itself afloat somehow. I'm not really quite sure how it's managing to do that with a bankrupt, an apparently bankrupt private bank. And that, again, is something that I'm still trying to get my head around, the fact that we have a place which is nominally a store of value that is actually owned. It's actually a collection, isn't it? It's a collection of private banks, and nobody's really sure who they are. Have they genuinely got no resource? You know, is this genuinely the case? What exactly do you think is happening there?
I think it's purely our belief system that keeps it all alive. I mean, it is a cultish idea to believe in paper receipts for some kind of weird economy to function. I mean, here's another question I ask people. What economy do you have? What is this economy they speak of when they say the economy? What does it relate to? I would suggest it relates to war. But I could be wrong. What do you think?
Well, that's certainly, I mean,
well,
there's several things there, aren't there? That you can generate a lot of value in the tools that you use to go and destroy the places that you're destroying, and then you can generate another load of value by going in and rebuilding it, and obviously
using subcontractors,
and what can be destroyed in seconds then takes years to rebuild.
Plus, whatever you're building becomes yours and your land.
Yeah.
So it gets your foot in the door, doesn't it, so to speak?
And it is amazing, isn't it, that an apparently bankrupt nation can have, I gather there's something I think it was in the Freedom to Fascism movie, it said there's 190 countries in the world, and America has military bases in 130 of them. And if that's not an imperial power, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's another one that's worth reading is the New American Century, PNAC, that document. It's about 90 pages, but it will systematically tell you which countries are to be invaded and the sequence of them and the horrible technology they're going to use. They don't really hide it either. When I read it, I was like talking to my brother. I was living with my brother at the time, and I'm reading this 90-page document. I'm saying to him, Jesus Christ, bro, you should fucking read this, man. It's horrifying. But all you'll ever hear is that Pearl Harbor quote out of it. That's the only thing they ever resource, all of these speakers and presentations. They'll always go, and they used PNAC, written in 2000, and it said, another Pearl Harbor. I'm like, well, did you read further in? You know, did you read towards the end of the document when it talks about systematically Libya, you know, all of these countries, one by one, fallen, being conquered, having a central bank emplaced in them, and then bringing artificial intelligence in onto the battlefield?
Which we'll get onto shortly, the artificial intelligence. I've just stumbled across that as well.
But that was that was written.
This is the other thing is, you know, how can it possibly be a cock-up when these people appear to be not just prophets with an F, but prophets with a PH? They do seem to know an awfully long way ahead which way they're going to go.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting phrase, that one, prophets. I always thought of it this way. You know, when you talk about the end, kind of the end of the game, where everyone sus the rules and they realize they're in a game. And you get to that moment where, do you really want to put the game back in the box? Or do you want to carry on, keep playing and, you know, go to the bank and say, can I lend more money because I'm bankrupt? Or do you want to just put the box away and say, nah, not playing this game no more. It's a silly game.
In the end, we're going to have absolutely no choice but to put all the money back in the box and put the game away and start playing for real. That's got to be where we're going. And the other point I wanted to make about war was something that was made clear to me. Well, I mean, it's been made pretty clear by Pat Valden's fantastic Scotland is Free show on a more or less weekly basis. But one of the things that's going on in war is that the real creditors are being killed.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what's happening. And, you know, I think that up until the First World War, it was, and even in the First World War, it was mostly what we might loosely call combatants, and just exactly why they were there is another matter entirely, but it was mostly combatants that were being killed, whereas nowadays a big noise is made when a single American soldier or English soldier or stuff is killed in war. It is mostly, and to a huge extent, civilian, normal people, women and children, who are being killed.
Yeah.
And, you know, a big thing is made about improvised explosive devices when the kind of weaponry that's being used by the other side is completely devastating.
Yeah, yeah, there's no parity to it. And I think that's what's more perverse about it is, you know, it's one guy saying, stop throwing stones at me, and yeah, he launches boulders. You know, it's insane to me, a lot of the things I see every day. And yeah. I think, why did you vote this in again? Why did you take part in this? You know, it's not going to get better for you. It can't. I don't see how it can get better when you keep voting and empowering it. You know, there's got to be a time when you pull out, you know, like jacking out the Matrix, like, you know, Neo does. Mm. Do you want to tell yet?
And of course, you know, if the cosmos is generally as much consciousness as it is energy and matter, then it's really important that people stop believing in it, because just the belief, let alone, you know, there's all the imaginary money and the funding and the voting and all that kind of stuff. But it seems to me that what we think and what we believe is as much part of what's going on as the fact that we are choosing, as we've just suggested, we are choosing, whether we know it or not, to put our resource into this instead of putting it into other things.
Yeah, especially when you hit a level where I would call you consciously ignorant, where you know you're part of the problem. But you won't change it because you're too fearful. And I totally understand that. We're all kind of in that same boat. But there comes a crossing point when you've got to put, you know, common sense aside and go, okay, I've got my common sense shield here. Fuck it. I'm going through it.
By and large, I think we all know the difference between right and wrong. And we all choose which side of the line we're standing on. which I take to be ultimately kind of, if you like, an optimistic viewpoint, because it means that consciously or subconsciously, the majority of people are already, as it were, on our side of the seesaw.
Yeah.
They've just got to acknowledge that that's where they are. And I know it's a big acknowledgement to make. And it does mean, well, it's like, as soon as you start to challenge one little bit of the, you can't challenge one little bit of the system and hope to chip away at that one. I've said it before, it's a bit like pulling a snag on a hand-woven jumper. You pull at that single snag and pretty soon you've just got maybe a cuff and half a sleeve left, and it's all just landing in ruins around you. And perhaps people realise that that's the case, and that's why so many people just don't want to take that first step. You know, whatever it is, saying refusing to pay for their TV license or RTS in the parking tickets or something like that. You know, just doing something that is really pretty simple and easy to pull off. Maybe people realise somewhere deep within them that once they do that, there is no going back.
Another thing to make clear as well is we don't really have government per se. We have houses of parliament where people seem to go and enact strange laws for you to abide by. Now, if you want to be like Pat Velden does on a Monday, if you want this idea of sovereignty, you're going to have to be government. You're going to have to be one and the same. Mm-hmm. You can't put them into an offer and say, you're government, you know. You're a public servant.
Well, they're only getting their power from one place, aren't they? And that's from the individuals that are giving them the power. And it's been said before that those that are not fit to govern themselves, perhaps such as those who choose to park in rose beds, are only fit to be governed. And the thing is that it is to do with the ceding of, with the jurisdiction, with the authority that's being ceded, is responsibility, and it's your responsibility, you know.
Yeah.
And it's again, also... if you're really, I guess if we're really, really used to, I don't know, phoning the police, phoning the RSPCA, phoning the social services, or any of these people, then it's perhaps really difficult to suddenly do the whole thing and say, no, look, sod it. I'm not only responsible for what I do, but because of what I do, I am responsible for all of this. You know, yeah. I'm personally responsible. We are all responsible for what's going on. And that's something that we really need to recognise, and the sooner the earlier.
Yeah. I mean, what's more concerning for me is you've got the idea of, people voting for some kind of thing called government. And then one of these strange people decide to write legislation which focuses on your children's health or your children's behaviour. And all of these strange rules and regulations begin applying to the parent. In other words, if you don't do as we say, for the rights of the child, that is, no, for the best interest of the child, the United Nations meme, if you don't do this, we're going to do this to you. So not only have you got government doing it, you're going to have a third party doing it, this quasi-agency, which are going to have all kinds of affiliations with all of your child's connections, whether they be school, teachers, social services. That's what's more problematic to me, is we're not dealing with that problem either. I mean, we've got a banking problem, sure we have, but they're after the children in nefarious ways.
Mm. And again, I think that if people genuinely realised what was happening to the children, and I mean, right away from the vilest end and the paedophilia, and which is now really pretty obvious and pretty verifiable, but right the way down to what's happening to education and the fact that your child is not necessarily, or your offspring is not necessarily spending their time in a place that's for their good, because they're forced to go there. You know, it is effectively, it's a prison camp, it's a government-sponsored daycare centre.
I think they're quite dangerous. I mean, I saw an article there where the poor old girl got battered. I mean, literally battered, while 100 of them are all doing nothing, apart from filming it.
Yeah.
And then you go home and your parent will obviously say, obviously, we're not going to send you to school anymore. And then the system just jumps all over and says, oh no, she's coming back to school. Don't let that disturb her. Mm. I'm like, you people are nuts. People are nuts.
Yeah.
School's dangerous. Now, I wouldn't have my kids in school. I'd be like, no, you're all nutters. You could take the Wi-Fi out, get the aspartame out the food, get all the other stuff that's poisoning the kids' mind and making them all hyper-aggressive. Then I might consider bringing my kid back. But up until now, no, they're getting homeschooled. Sorry, you're unsafe. I've risk assessed you. I've done what you do to me. I've made my assessments and you're too fucking risky to say my child, my offspring there, my property.
Mm.
So this is me. When I start seeing more of that, then I'll be happy. When the parents go, no, no more.
But again, not I guess,
free either.
Yeah, I guess. And I gather that Ofsted are now involved in inspecting people who are homeschooling. But again, I suppose you have to consent to that. Like Laurie's put in the chat box there, the power is only given by those who consent. And we've actually seen, haven't we? We've seen policemen, we've seen lawyers, we've seen politicians saying we are governed, stroked, policed by consent.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure that it's entirely apparent to people just exactly what that means. It does mean that by handing over your consent, by failing to take responsibility, you are in some sense complicit in the conspiracy. Or the cock-up. Yeah. It doesn't matter which it is, actually, in those terms. You know, you're complicit in it, whichever it is. It's in a way, I suppose, it's a bit of a straw argument, isn't it?
It was like a case where there was a cyclist on the road, and for some bizarre reason, he happened to crash into the back of it. So apparently the court case went ahead, and he got done for dangerous cycling, and the reaction was kind of hysterical, because I thought, well, if that was anything else, normal, common law would apply. You damaged his property. just because he's a cyclist, you know, it's not that big of a deal. He should have been aware. He did get done for careless driving because he crashed into someone. You know, it's a no-brainer. But it was the first of its kind. But I was like, well, you should have got done, though, because it is technically damage.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've got no problem with that. But anything else, like you've got to go and register your bicycle. No. No, I won't be registering my bicycle anything anytime soon.
Absolutely not. I can well see them going for registration of cycles and licenses and insurance and all that kind of stuff.
They want you to have a bicycle license because there's a motorist versus cycle war going on. Have you not noticed?
Yeah. It does seem to be that definitely some people in charge of four-wheel machines have got it in not only for pedal cyclists but for motorcyclists too. I've had some very interesting times on both kinds of machine.
Yeah, but the bicycle is very hard to enforce because they're talking specifically about motor vehicles. And while you're on a bike, or if you're using the road, the only thing they can really technically do is pull you over, and then you have to pull over, you have to stop. So if you're ever on a bike, on a road, and you get the wee wee wee, do stop. But you're not obliged to give them any blood samples or any breath tests because they need your consent.
But can't you, are you not expected to drive to a place where you deem it safe to stop?
Yeah, absolutely, but when they're kind of wearing their things to call you over, yeah, find a safe place, but do stop. Yeah, because you are obliged to.
I was under the mistaken impression that they weren't allowed to use their blue lights unless they were heading for a place where harm and damage was being caused, and that therefore it couldn't be anything to do with me if I was just kind of, you know, trucking along.
Exactly, so you'd probably just pull to the side anyway, just out of courtesy, because he'd be in an emergency, wouldn't he?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so you can work that to your own advantage, I suppose.
So, do we genuinely think that society actually needs a government?
Not a government as we visualise it today, no. We need self-governance, self-responsibility, you know. Obligate ourselves to do the right things and not follow down this sheep dip that we're all heading towards with the digital system. That's going to be very hard to get out of and very hard to change.
Well, it's certainly pretty well embedded and it's pretty well huge as well. But it does strike me, and again, this is something that I believed a long time before I started discovering just how badly tits up everything had gone. I had this suspicion that far from us paying the government taxes, they should actually be paying us. And it turns out that, again, Pat's on that one as well, saying, you know, we should be getting some return on our equity rather than just having it taken off us day after day after day.
Yeah, which is probably why we need to evict some of these people from their office, because they're blatantly abusing it. I mean, how can they write their own little rules into their own little quasi assessment group or committee when they say, oh yeah, we will give you 11% pay rise because we think you deserve it? It's like, excuse me, wouldn't you like to ask me, because I'd like to kind of figure out if you're worth 11% more. Sat in your office writing, what have you written again? Oh yeah, lots of legislation which was negative and taxed more. Yeah, why would I give you an increase in wage for that again? You know, if this was you or I working in any kind of other company, our bosses would be going, who do you think you are? You know, giving yourself a pay rise. What exactly do you do again? But these people just take carte blanche and just say, well, sod it. Not like they care.
And again, more and more that's the case, isn't it? Again, when I was younger, this was quite a productive set of islands. We were actually making and selling a whole load of things, but and more we see, well, certainly the growth of government and quasi-government institutions. More and more we see people involved in financial services. It's really huge now, isn't it? When you think what they're actually servicing, every single one of them, either knowing it or not, is a kind of fraudster. I mean, I'm sure the ladies sitting behind the Mutual Building Society counter have absolutely no idea what they're doing, and that makes them technically innocent, but there's loads of people involved in financial services and especially the sale of mortgages and the like who do know that they're breaking even the legislative rules, let alone the rules of honesty.
It's one of those things where you're going to have to look at yourself again, I think. You know, if you're in one of these jobs and there's something niggling in the back of your head that you don't like the job that you do, maybe there's a reason. I think most of us have gone through this where you just hate your job all of a sudden. You're like, what the hell am I doing this for? You know.
And the question then...
What's that point yet? I don't know.
The question then is, you know, do you have the balls to move on?
Yeah. It's fear. Fear, fear, fear. I mean, I can speak from experience firsthand on this because I had exactly the same problem. 2007, I was going to get made redundant because we'd seen all our factory stuff get outsourced to Germany and Spain and all these other places. So we were all heading for the chopper. We knew it. This guy came in. He's obviously a company liquidator. He was a hatchet man, what we called him. And he just started sacking people. So, you know, we're kind of against the clock. Redundancy, voluntary, could I afford to even do it? I'd just bought a house. You know, I had a mortgage. I thought, well, I can't really take redundancy because it's not going to last very long. You know, not many jobs out there. Had to retrain completely in something different, completely different. So, long story short, the year later, I was fortunate enough to get a decent little redundancy package. But I put it all towards my mortgage for a year, and I thought, well, if I can't get a job in 12 months' time, I'm going to have to sell the house. It's as simple as that. And I was engaged, you know, with a fiancé, and I said to her outright, look, we've got 12 months counting down now. If this money runs out and I ain't got a job and I can't find one, this has to go up in the market 3 months before, so we're selling it by Christmas or we lose it. It's as simple as that, because this market's rigged. It's completely rigged. So lucky enough, you know.
Yeah, and is that the way it fell out for you? Is that the way it went?
Well, that's when I started having lots of strange mystical experiences, like mad dreams and things talking to me and telling me maybe I should consider this. And long story short, I just left everything behind and moved to Brighton. Mm-hmm. But it ties in with all the other stuff because, again, watching the mortgage market and being involved with it and looking at the con and how Gordon Brown booby-trapped the whole lot. I mean, once he deregulated the market and gave people 4, 5, 6 times their own wage, he got everyone in a trap. So when it crashed in 2008, it should have fully crashed, but it didn't. They bridged it. They stopped it falling. It should have corrected itself then. Now we're 7 years on, and that weights, you know. I don't even know the magnification of how big it is now, but those struts are creaking. That can't hold much longer.
Can even see it happening out here in Mid Wales now. The prices that are being asked for,
yeah,
really quite small properties in places where there honestly aren't any jobs, and where there's actually an ever decreasing infrastructure for supporting the people that are out here, is really quite astonishing. Anybody would think they were trying to price people out of the country and into the cities, eh?
Yeah, the Agenda 21 cities, yeah. We're seeing a lot of these things creeping in, and when you start putting it all together, you see something very bad coming in, but it's hard to put it all together. People don't see it because there's so much going on, and there's so many smoke bombs in the news, you can't really concentrate on any one thing.
Well, I think you really need to distract yourself mainly from the news, because I do encounter newspapers, and occasionally people are reading things out, and even if any of it was real, which I think a lot of it isn't, it doesn't have any direct application to the people who are necessarily reading it. The stuff that's coming out of London is very different from what's actually going on the ground in Mid Wales. And I mean, like my dad, I'm sure my dad used to buy the Daily Telegraph just because it made him angry. It's almost like he wanted his daily dose of anger. And I'm thinking, well, why spend your pennies on something that does that to you? Why not? There's so many other things out there that you could be reading that would either be informative or useful, or maybe even just fun, and certainly better written than the kind of things that you're reaching to there.
Yeah. I wouldn't even call half of these tabloid periodicals or whatever they're called, these newspapers, I wouldn't call any of it journalism. It's kind of laughable. I'd say most of the people on People's Internet Radio are better researchers, more knowledgeable, and put things into context better than half of these journalists, even when they try and attempt a normal article. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
Mm.
So I can understand why people are confused, because they're just shit writers. They don't even inform the public of anything. You've got to read between the lines.
No, that's exactly right. I think the actual, the standard of writing and the breadth of the vocabulary and quite often the understanding of the subject matter are frequently derisory, I think.
It's written in a very childlike format. Do you know what I mean? The syntax is, if I was going to write that for a seven-year-old, I would write in a certain syntax. And they write a very strange way. It's not like they're trying to use common vernacular. It's just a very strange syntax when you read half the time these journalists, because they all write in the same kind of style now as well. It's very odd.
And like I say, there's a very limited variety of words being used. It is really quite like 1984, this kind of newspeak. It's anodyne and sort of phrases slip into use and then they turn up in all the newspapers and nobody ever seems to really bother to examine the issues. And then there's the idea that, you know, I remember those split capital investment trusts, which were, they were sold throughout the national press. You know, everybody was going, this is a really great idea, this is absolutely brilliant. And then when it all came tumbling down as another mis-selling scandal stroke fraud, they almost to a man were going, oh, well, we told you. You know, they really can shift their position suddenly from one day to the next. And nobody seems to notice it happening.
People just seem to miss a lot of what's going on. But you can understand to some level.
Perhaps it's just because they're too busy to remember.
But going back to governments, I mean, how do you change the mindset of people when we see the internet, for example, as a wonderful infrastructure? We would all agree on that, yeah?
Yeah.
How do we stop this going into a so-called intra-governmental system where we have no control over it? As sovereign people, how do we get sovereignty over the internet when we have a entity that's trying to basically compromise all of it and jack you onto another one? Where they can pretty much control everything.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a very good question, isn't it?
I mean, this isn't ours, is it? We've claimed ownership of it, publicly. But this isn't ours. We never created it. We've helped create it.
Well, we've made ourselves a load of little human data nodes that are much easier to keep track of and watch and quantify than we were before.
Yeah, we've placed ourselves onto the grid. Should we have done that in the first place will be a question.
Well, I must admit, I certainly find myself frequently asking that question because, if nothing else, it takes up a whole lot of time that used to be spent out in the real world doing real things.
Exactly, exactly.
To a certain extent, I don't kind of resent it, but I remember, here we go, I remember the phone arriving at our house, and that in itself was an interesting kind of invasion of privacy, but it was kind of directly useful in that, you know, people could phone you when they wanted to, you could phone them when you wanted to, but then we got the fax machine, then we got the mobile phone with the message service, and we got the internet and emails, and all of these things. I mean, I don't know about you, but it takes me a while to see to emails, and there's quite a lot of them every day. It's maybe an hour's worth of time, which I wouldn't have had to do. And the same is really true of messages on mobile phones and your 1571 on the main line, on the phone line and all that kind of stuff. So, but at the same time, there is a payoff, isn't there? I mean, I wouldn't be without people's internet radio and some of the other things to which I subscribe on the internet, because I suppose I find them to be really useful. I wouldn't be able to be here having this conversation with you without the technology that we're using, and it wouldn't be worth us doing it without the knowledge we're getting from it. I can, and then there's Freeman Jack's argument, isn't there, that intelligence has actually created somehow a huge electronic brain at which every single human being is a kind of node, and yeah. That the internet is itself a kind of evolution. But like you're saying, we've got to somehow take ownership of it. And I mean, do you think, to any extent at all, if we could all be bothered to set up private encrypted voice over internet protocols and encrypted email and that kind of stuff. Do you think that if enough people did that, that would be enough?
I suppose it comes down to two questions. What do you want the internet to behave like? Me personally, I would like to see it as a huge digital library of Alexandria where you can just go in there freely and have all of the knowledge that you can ever wish for, all the books, all the codes, all the deciphering tools, everything you need to enlighten yourself. I just don't want the other one they're planning where they need my biometric to access the commercial digital framework, the digital wonderland. I don't want that. But that's where they're heading us.
Yes, and they're definitely starting to restrict access to things. I've been reading about Google's Knowledge Vault, which is apparently intended to basically, well, for want of a better word, it's intended to measure sites for truthiness, which is something like how closely they approximate, I don't know, to some sort of CIA general guidance on what knowledge is permissible, and to steer people away from sites like this one.
I mean, what exactly is truth? I mean, that's subjective in itself.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, one of my most recent realisations has been just how much guff the history was that I was taught at school. But to all, or you know, indeed these military specialists I've been talking to, they absolutely believe what they're saying because it's in so many books and written by so many people.
Yeah.
And in a way, that seems to be the modern measure of truth. Whether there actually is anything such as truth, because, you know, if consciousness is playing a part in manifesting reality, then truth is absolutely and physically different for everybody, and it's not a democratic process. It's not like if say 5,000 million of the 7,000 million people that nominally live here believe the earth was flat, I don't think it would necessarily become flat as a result of that.
Yeah. I'm not saying that one.
So what, I mean, you know, it seemed to me that the conclusion of that little audio bit we heard earlier is that the people that we elect every time turn out to be corrupt, evil, lying crooks, which does seem to be the fundamental basis of the whole thing, and yet we keep doing it.
Well, evil's an interesting concept when you say that, but it depends how you look at it. For example, we all know that the court system and the legal system in general is fictional. It's a shadow realm of the undead, where corpses exist. You know, corporations. That's the dark square on the chessboard. That's the fictional realm, that's the shadow world. We don't really belong there. So if you think everything that happens in that legal realm is warfare and death and cultish behavior, you can see why it's evil, because you're in the shadow. Now, if you get out the legal system and go up to the white square, you know, then you'd be in a lawful system where you got a bit of honesty and dignity and honesty, truth, diligence, responsibility. But we don't. We operate in the legal realm, so we are basically in the realm of the dead, the underworld. Again, if you want to look esoterically at this kind of stuff, which is what I do, you're in a necromantic underworld system, because this is the system that's being created around us. Weird, eh?
Yeah, and that's absolutely the case. And this is not a subject that I get to cover every day with people, really, because they find it so difficult to deal with the idea of what mortgages are and what money is and what schools are and what vaccines are and all that sort of stuff. I just don't think it would be helpful to be telling them that we are actually, it is already a zombie apocalypse, and that nearly everybody they see on the streets is actually a dead person.
George Romero, just as a little segue, George Romero, you know what he'd done his zombie movies?
They were brilliant, man. They were really great. And again, they were really kind of prophetic, I suspect.
Well, you know what he said? The reason why he created zombies was his representation of American society. Just walking dead. I haven't got a fucking clue. It wasn't zombies, but the American people. That was his portrayal of them in zombie movies. Funny that, isn't it?
Mm. They were the Dawn of the Dead and the Day of the Dead. He did a trilogy of them, didn't he?
Yeah, I love Romero. He's cool.
Very, very stylish movies indeed.
Yeah.
So, do we think that... do we think that there is a solution to government? Do we think that... Because another meaning for it is mind control, isn't it? Do we think that these things that we see kind of starting to flower now... I mean, I must admit, I listen to the podcasts that are coming out of Ireland... And the hedge schools and the water charge reaction, you know, people not registering for it, and
yeah,
the I can't remember what the Irish word for it is, people getting together to help each other fulfil projects.
Yeah.
I think it strikes me that Ireland is setting a really cracking example of what a population might be able to do. Do you think these things are going to be carryable forward to the point where we start seeing them actually making a difference to the way we live? Because really, we have to. You're not going to be able to fight government. There's no point in trying to fix a system which is doing exactly what it's designed to do. In the end, the only way is going to be to disenfranchise them, isn't it? It's going to be to turn your back on them and do the other thing.
There's a good analogy I could use, and there's a movie analogy of this, and it's After Earth with Will, what's his name, Will Smith. If you look at that movie with the right eyes, he says everything on Earth is designed to kill you. Everything's a predator. After Earth, you know, after the collapse.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point of the movie is once he loses his fear, he becomes invisible to the predator.
Right.
That's just what you're doing. You're extricating yourself from the system, so you just leave it behind and you don't fear it. Therefore, it doesn't really have any power to harm you. Because you've realised fear. Conquer your fear, you're laughing.
And you kind of experienced that, didn't you, when you came to the conclusion that you were going to have to sell the house or whatever it is you were doing, and then you started having the dreams and started having realisations of other potentials, and... I've been through that process myself as well, that actually when you've got your head down, when you're frightened, when you're doing what you're told to do and not what you want to do, when you're failing to take responsibility for things that you begin to realise are your responsibility,
yeah,
there's a whole load of things that you don't notice going on around you. And in fact, it does seem to me that the world is a bit more like the Celestine prophecies, that once you are a bit more open to these things, once you're untrammelled by debt or benefit or whatever it is we want to call it,
yeah,
then opportunities arise that you for a start off, you can notice them, and you wouldn't necessarily have noticed them when you were so busy. And secondly, you're in a position to take advantage of them. Thirdly, perhaps most significantly, it becomes kind of necessary to move with the way things are moving around you, because you're no longer on the 9-to-5 or the week to week or whatever it is. And again, that I think is a fair indication of how the world can manifest for us differently when we start to see things differently.
If you've got the world's woes on top of your shoulders or on your mind, the last thing you're going to do is think, oh, I'll go on the internet and research something I'm very interested in finding out about, like, you know, fractional reserve banking or, you know, money creation. You know, you're going to be thinking, how the hell am I going to pay these, or how am I going to do this, or how am I going to do that, and oh my God, that's happened and shit. You know, so when you look at around you, how many people are experiencing, not the minor ones, but the major stresses like mortgage debt and mortgage arrears, which we're always talking about on here. They're not the ones who are coming on the internet to look for interesting things to find. They're just trying to find out, well, where can I borrow money? Where can I get, you know, I'll ring this agency or I'll ring this government body. It's getting through to these people that there is support for them without going to these government agencies, because they're there to snare you as well.
And again, those kind of solutions really... the kind of solutions we're talking about here, although they appear to be small, they can exactly buy people the kind of space they need for the sort of realisation we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to take time, but I think if we do this slowly, I mean, I call this little phrase lawful resignation. I've just stopped commercially buying things off all of these child companies of the parents, you know, whether they be Primark, Sony, whoever. They're all children of the very same parents. So no matter where you're giving your money to it, it's all going to the same place. So you might as well just feed them all. But there's going to come a time when you can't support every single one of them. Now, there won't be enough tokens to go around, so some are going to have to fall. Now, can we control this from our point of view? Can we empower our systems and our communities and pull the finance from them? Don't know.
Well, it strikes me that that's definitely the way we have to look at things, is that the kind of monolithic system that we've developed around ourselves over God knows how many thousands of years is beyond everybody's comprehension. It's beyond the ability to actually manipulate it. But ultimately, people are really good, especially when they're under pressure, at coming up with solutions, at actually making things work for themselves. And it does seem to me that solutions, if they are going to be found, are going to be found at the local level. And the real wealth, if the money is a fiction, which we know that it is, then the real wealth has to be somewhere else. And I think the real wealth is in each other.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And it is possible to go through life earning quite a lot less money, because the wealth is payable in, I don't know, I mean, I call it social capital, you know, in the value that you have for other people and that they have for you is much more important in the long run than a bank account. And, you know, since we wandered away from the Stone Address, and since we started on this rather irregular and, dare I say, anarchic path, I think it's true to say that to start with, even people who knew us quite well were actually pretty alarmed by it and not very trusting of it. But we've been at it for 4 years now, and I feel that we've got to know people a lot better. There's much higher levels of trust. And the amount of love, friendship and support that we get from the people around us is absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
And the thing is, at the moment, I mean, there's a lot more of us than there were 5 years ago, and there's a lot more of us than there were 10 years ago, but at the moment we're still a tiny fraction of the population. The kind of difference that could be made, if we can get it to the point where there's many, many more of us, then so much the better. I think the amount of difference that could be made is possibly beyond our imagining. And most of all, we're stepping out of what you called the shadow. We're starting once again to see the light. And as you say, the most important thing is, I guess, not to be frightened. I do sometimes, when I wake up in the morning, especially, I am not chipper, shall we say. Generally speaking, once I get in amongst people again, once I get into the garden or whatever it is I'm doing, then I'm all right with it. And in a way, the state of things has become such that we just cannot have this anymore. This just can't be allowed to go on the way it is. And it's got to change. And if that change involves a degree of chaos, which I suspect it possibly might, then so much the better. This is not the kind of world we can leave our children and our children's children in. It's just not responsible to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it is, we can either allow them to continue their game plan and collapse the banks at their own, you know, moment, whenever they choose to, or we can grab it by the steer and go, no, I tell you what, we're going to force your hand on this one. I'm going to see what you do, and just pull one giant down. Now, you might get a 9.5 Richter scale on the metaphysical level, you know, because I can imagine this will physically cause an earthquake. Don't know why. Got this weird idea in my head that if that fell, you'd have a big earthquake, really. So do you want a 9.5 when they collapse it, or do you want a 4.4 when we do it? By slowly pulling support from it and exposing it for what it is. And if it's bankrupt, close it. Simple. It doesn't exist anymore. Let's exorcise the demons.
Yeah, and
they need to go. They need to fall. We need to allow them to fall at our discretion, not at their behest.
And to a certain extent, it does seem that people are far more likely to be making these kind of realizations again once they find themselves under pressure. And because things are the way they are, more and more people are finding themselves under that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
I've found myself accidentally occupying the dark side of the room occasionally recently, because I've been listening to your shows and the stuff about DARPA and things like that.
Yeah.
And in an attempt to try and find out how it was that this Operation Jade Helm there, you know, planning on running in the States was actually going to work, I was thinking, well, how are they going to get away with putting 12,000 troops onto the ground in something like 9 states,
yeah,
and declaring Texas to be an enemy-occupied state? How are they going to get away with using so few people? And I'm sure you've been looking into it at all as well. It would surprise me if you hadn't. And what I've found has suggested to me that really we need to be acting absolutely now, because Jade is apparently a computer program.
Uh-huh.
And it seems that it's more or less self-aware. It's being fed all of the information that's being harvested by, I don't know, GCHQ and the NSA and all of that.
Yeah.
And apparently the reason why Obama has been firing so many of his top brass is because they're effectively removing humans from the decision-making chain and just leaving it all to this quantum computer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you been looking into that? Have you found out anything about that?
I play a little music pod, don't I, when there's a little snippet from what's-his-name in America, when he says, guess how many drones he went up in the air by 2015? 30,000 of them. Well, look at the carnage drones do.
Yeah.
So there's the answer. It's all getting roboticized. But again, this was in PNAC. PNAC talked about this, you know, in 2000, they're going to start bringing artificial intelligence into the warfare game.
And how do you spell PNAC?
PNAC, Project for the New American Century.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, Project for the New American Century. Oh, we shall look that one up.
But it'll give you the timeline and the nation states that they'd like to conquer in sequence, 5 of them. Get a central bank in and then operate. Operate the United States in a constabulary force role where they take their military bases permanently as constabulary forces, peacekeepers. And they're going to do that while they're running 4 simultaneous wars. How many have you got now?
Oh, about that, I would think.
It's close, isn't it? Apart from all the United States and Fallujah and all the other ones, you've got more than 4 wars, and that's what their goal is, to manage warfare simultaneously, to prove that they can be guardians of the Earth. That document will tell you. It's crazy. When I read it, I was shaking my head going, oh my God, why don't people know this?
Yeah, and it's in the public domain, it's available. But I mean, to a certain extent, you know, I now look at things like Brave New World and 1984.
And yeah.
I mean, 1984 was written, he wanted to call it 1948, but they wouldn't let him, apparently. And now we are, it's one of the things the internet has brought us, is this kind of news speak, this kind of rolling news where one thing can be true one day, something else can be true the next day, and where we know that a lot of the stuff, and you know, a lot of the stuff is literally staged. Again, I remember when we first came across this idea of crisis actors, you know, the idea that they've got a bunch of people who they make up differently, and they'll interview them after 9/11 and interview them after Columbine or something like that.
Yeah, the same woman pops up, yeah.
Yeah, and I was at a Lawful Solutions meeting in Manchester, so I was up there with, you know, Darren DOG and Guy Taylor, and the man from the Lawful Bank was there as well, Roger. Quite an interesting crew of people by and large, and I remember us sitting around, and it was news to nearly everybody at the table. But it means that it's all kind of a drama, And it is stunning to realise how much of it is simply being fabricated. And that is really how the 1984 news worked.
Yeah, 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 completely. I mean, when I remember reading Brave New World Revisited, and then I read 1984, and I thought to myself, well, we're definitely going towards the Brave New World model, but I don't think we're going to get to the 1984 idea, because that's pretty much authoritarian dictatorships. I can't see us getting there, because there's artificial intelligence in this. But here's a funny thing I thought about. You know, when you talk about CERN and Shiva,
yeah,
dancing on the dead.
Yeah.
Remember Terminator? What's the very first scene in Terminator? Crushing skulls, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just thought that was a funny thing to notice. Mm-hmm. Is Shiva really artificial intelligent? Is that what they mean? These gods are artificial intelligent.
Well, I wonder if we've been here before.
What's Battlestar Galactica, Caprica territory, aren't we?
Yeah, a lot of truth in the science fiction.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to look into. To be honest, it seems to be in the middle of it all. That's why I like the occult so much, because once you know a bit more occult stuff, the news articles kind of bend you in a certain way, and you go, ah, I know what your language is. I know that word, and you get an idea of what they're talking about.
So it is astonishing to think that we are basically living in a huge ecclesiastical system, because that's the other thing about government, isn't it, is that they are ministers, so they are ministers of the church.
It all stems from pharaohship and kingship, doesn't it? You know, apparently all of this was supposed to end in the 16th century with the divine right of kings, when it ended, when we had apparent bills of rights and all this good stuff. So it went on for a long time, up until, you know, 400 years ago, when this idea of divine right of kings ended, when we got apparent Magna Carta common law, or whatever it was then. Commonwealth, wasn't it? The 16th century. We joined the Commonwealth with the Bill of Rights.
Commonwealth is a great word, isn't it?
Oh, it's lovely. But it's another corporation.
Yeah. Well, there isn't anything out there that isn't, is there, really? And I mean, you know, until we realise it, even we are corporations, apparently.
The best way of looking at it is Camp UK is just one big farm. And in 2012, the Queen, the shepherd, she sold all of her flock to the United Nations and put us all under their care as citizens.
Did she get money for that?
I have no idea, probably. I just know she signed a signed manual on it, which means Her Majesty didn't sign it, the Queen did. So yeah, she transferred property that day. Just like registration, she moved all the entire registration of the United Kingdom to the United Nations under their auspices. It says under Clause 3 of the Commonwealth Charter, it said quite clearly, you've just gone under the United Nations.
Yeah, I was thinking about what you said about charters earlier on, and I realised that Commonwealth, I'm writing some of this down, I'll be looking some of this up. It's very educational, thank you very much. It occurred to me that that the cities are actually founded or made or created by charter, aren't they?
City of London was, yeah.
Just the City of London.
Yeah, you usually get cities when you get granted a city status when your population hits a certain expansion. You know, I think it's 1 million people maybe. We got it in Brighton a couple of years ago because the population grew to a certain amount. So you go from a county to a city, or a borough, I should say, a borough to a city. Because both boroughs merged, Brighton and Hove became one borough. Therefore, it got itself granted city status, but it doesn't really give it much, doesn't change anything. But yet they got a charter granting it from Queen.
Does it mean that the actual structure of the kind of places we're living in is itself a kind of governmental institution? Well, certainly corporate. Is it governmental as well?
No, it entitles you to the title of citizen. That's all. You're a city dweller. That's what citizen is.
So what are those of us who don't live in cities called?
You'd be a denizen, probably. You know, someone who's outside the city. We're always talking about fictional boundaries and walled cities. You know, it's a classical Roman thing. You wall your city, you fortify it. Because London used to be called a fortress, by the way. Did you know that?
I did, yeah.
Yeah. So they fortified the wall and it's got its own city status, wherefore it's tax exempt. Everything around it, you know, is, they think, jurisdiction. It's their territory, which is the language I'm starting to see now. In America, they've gone to territories and it's really strange. They're going after territory, not districts or zones, but territory, jurisdictional territorial or something like that, territorial jurisdiction.
Which is kind of, I guess, it's an admission of what it's always been, isn't it?
Well, if you think of Jade Helm being, you know, this kind of war code or war program, it makes you wonder why these have all been designated, you know, territorial jurisdictions. What's going to take jurisdiction? Very interesting language, I know that much.
It certainly is, because they're kind of determining, aren't they, that that one of them's going to be, one of them's sort of definitely unfriendly and one of them's potentially friendly, some of them are unknown. Do you think we're actually going to get to see how this thing unfolds?
I think they're serious enough to try it, yeah? Don't you?
Because, I mean,
set off nuclear bombs, I mean, anything's possible with them, the lunatics.
Well, I mean, the thing is, as far as I can see, you're sort of removing the lunatics from the equation. If you're putting a machine actually in charge,
yeah,
which has no regrets and has no morals,
yeah,
and has only kind of algorithms and a kind of prefigurative sense of what it is people are going to do as their behavior deviates from standard norms and stuff, then anything is possible. And it definitely is a kind of, the thing I thought about when I was hearing all of this was Terminator. That was exactly it. Skynet.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I had a dream ages ago. I'll share this with you. I've never shared this with anyone before, but I had this vision years ago and it just came out of nowhere, but I'm walking down the street and it was just a picture of Google. Google went live. Right. We've inputted so much information into the artificial god, Google. The Google one day became live and started taking decision-making parameters off people. And what it did was treated every single human like a number. And it said, okay, all the information I've been fed by you humans is you're all overpopulated, so I'll deal with that. I'll judge you. And all of a sudden, all of these numbers get crunched, and it makes better ratios. So if there was 300 million there, there's only 330 million now. So it rebalances all the numbers in a very nice pattern along the globe, in every grid, to a more manageable size, and humans don't even have a part of it. It just designates numbers to the machines, and they go around in there. Yeah, cool. I hope that doesn't come true, but that was a horrible, horrible vision, just walking down the street for no reason, and I got that. The whole thing just went live and decided to make decisions, and, yeah, treated everything like a bar graph, literally. And took all the information that we'd input over the lifespan of it, and it basically said, okay, I'm listening to all of you, I'll make some major decisions, and I'll do it. Because I've been empowered by these people to do it. I've got self-awareness now. So I'll exert my authority. This is what we need to do.
Yeah, we do sound to be getting precious close to that. So where do we think the solutions lie? That's the question.
Well, what do we do with the internet as an infrastructure? How do we somehow wrestle control of it or separate it or decouple it from what it is currently? You know, it's linked to GHCQ, it's linked to DARPA. I mean, DARPA created the thing, so everything's going to the artificial mind, whatever we do on it. It's getting our opinions, it's working out algorithms of our mood, our vocal inflections, the tone of our voice, if we're sad or lonely, if we're angry or mad. I mean, do we really want to go there with that, or do we want to treat it like this? You know, a place where we meet, converse, exchange information, a library of such? Or do we want a horrible commercial world where we can't really do much and we get fined for everything we do? Or everything we say will be copyrighted, or it'll be a phrase that will cost you something to send to someone and they'll have to pay something to receive it? I mean, that's what the United Nations is trying to do with the internet. Everything.
Well, I mean, they've kind of got us used to that with the mobile phones, haven't they?
Pretty much. I mean, you might get roaming charges thrown off you when you go abroad, but they're still collecting the data. We don't have control over that.
No. No.
Well, we could go back to carrier pigeons. It's the ultimate private mail, isn't it? Unless you shoot me pigeon down.
Mm-hmm. We'll go back to meeting each other in noisy places.
It's funny you mentioned phones before. I mean, I remember we got our first phone, and it was kind of like a shock to the system because it was so loud. Never heard someone scream so loud before.
Mm.
It's the only thing I really remember about phones. Ours didn't really ring that much apart from people trying to figure out if we were at home so we could burgle us. That's the only time people had a phone.
No, you're right, they were quite noisy machines. Yeah.
But that's what burglars used to do. They'd test your phone to see if you were in or not, see if you'd answered the phone, and then they'd suddenly hang up on you. That was as harassing as we got back then. But nowadays, I don't even plug my phone in. I've got one, but I don't plug it in. Why would I give a channel to some weird company to invite me to buy something off them? You know, this voice from the darkness, hello, would you like to buy this? Oh, yeah, sure, love to.
There is certainly an amazing amount of tat that comes over it. I must admit, mine's not on very often, and I lose it quite a lot. But I regard it as a machine that I use for getting in touch with other people rather than for other people getting in touch with me. I've tried to herd everybody onto email because at least that way it's kind of it's focused and I can settle down and see it and deal with it. The mobile itself, I'm pretty distrustful of it, and the one I've got is a really ancient Nokia. It's not actually capable of very much.
Yeah, I've had a Sony Ericsson for God knows how long. I won't change it.
No. But actually really, really robust, reliable things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I can definitely, you know, there's been several times when I've been thinking, actually, I could do with a smartphone, you know, because I could do my Skype on the hoof. I wouldn't have to do it all when I get home. I could actually interview people on the phone and record them, which would be an incredibly useful thing to do. I can imagine circumstances in which it would be extremely useful to be able to film what's going on around me. But I just haven't quite been able to bring myself to do it.
I was listening to something today and it was a bit strange, but it was a woman and she was talking about computers and microchips. And she was trying to link it with imps and demons being inside the computer chips and having all of these... you know when your computer gets hot? It's because these are inside it.
Running around.
And they're trying to annoy you by setting off viruses and closing your computer down when you don't want it to. And I'm like, that's the craziest thing I've heard on the internet for so long.
They do have demons in them, don't they?
Apparently so.
I'm sure that none of these things are named by accident.
It was just an interesting connection she was trying to make, saying that they're all sealed with sigils. So whenever you take components out of your computer, make sure you don't scrub these words or the curse will be broken.
Like I say, 7,000 million different people, 7,000 million different worlds.
I like everyone's ideas, you know, I don't agree with everyone's, but they're still nice to listen to.
Oh, I think so, and I think it makes life a lot easier and I think it's necessary. If we're going to stay peaceful and conversive and communicative, and if we're going to stand any chance of getting our message across at all, then it's really important, nutters that we are, that we're actually able to listen with a degree of empathy to everybody's ideas, because let's face it, nearly everything we've been told was a lie. We don't actually really know what's going on at all. We can't possibly know most things, or indeed even a fraction of them. So given that everything is a story, I think it's really interesting meeting other people and hearing what their version of the story is. The thing I find most disturbing is the number of times individuals' versions of the story is just coming at me straight out of newspapers. You know, immigrants are coming here because this is the easiest place in Europe to get benefits. And I'm thinking, well, I know it's not easy to get benefits. And even when you are getting them, it's not easy to be on them and all of that. And I'd much rather hear really, really outrageous and apparently crazy ideas that would never be published by any newspaper, because I know that, you know, they're somehow coming up. Maybe they got them off the internet or whatever, but I actually really enjoy engaging with people with novel ideas. I think it's a much better idea.
It is when we consider that the artificial intelligence, Jade Helm, you know, things of that nature, and, you know, they're kind of plausible on some level, even though it sounds batshit nuts. On one level, I can kind of agree and think, yeah, it's plausible. In some crazy, batty way, it's plausible. You know.
Yeah.
Antimatter, you know, creating, you know, demonic people isn't outside the realms of norms either for me.
No.
Especially if CERN opens up and people go a bit doolally. You know, I'd be pointing at that going, yeah, it's probably that. Wouldn't surprise me.
So it does seem to me that in terms of, you know, in kind of closing, because I'm going to play a 15-minute John Langan track at the end. I'm going to play some wicked John Langan called The Demented Set, because it seems that we're in a pretty demented world. And it seems to me that the business of taking responsibility, part and parcel of that, is sticking responsibility to the people that are doing this to us. And I mean, the point was made in the audio that government can't just walk up to us in the streets and demand money. They can only do that when they're doing their job, which is obviously, I mean, I don't know whether he knew, but he is making effectively the distinction between the man and the office there.
Yeah.
It does seem to me that through Robert Sproul and Guy Taylor and the various people that are working with him, that we are edging our way towards actually dealing with the man or the woman that's in front of us rather than with the office. And if that was to happen on any scale, again, we could start seeing some sort of changes. Do you see that as a potential solution, or at least a decent thing to be chivvying away at whilst we're here dancing on the edge of time?
I think it's admirable that anyone does the things that, you know, those fellas are doing. There should be more of us doing it, but, I mean, if they're the four horsemen leading the way, you know, I'm thankful for them. But we all should be doing our own little things, you know, self-government. Choosing where you place your tokens and your energy. Sharing a bit of the wisdom, a bit of the knowledge. There's little things, they will all mount up, but we're just running out of time. That's the only problem. This thing's going a little bit fast for me.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from, but at the same point, resolution will be made on the end of a pin, won't it? And so long as you're doing your best, you can't do better than that. And I still stick with the idea that Juliet put across to me, which is the only thing you've got to offer the world is your own transformation. None of the rest of it is your problem, so long as you're working on yourself. And I also remember Tamash, when he was on the show talking about community in Colombia that he was trying to set up. He'd lived in all sorts of communities, as have we now.
Yeah.
And he's lived in some quite well-functioning ones. And he said the point at which the community stopped functioning was when any individual within the community stopped working on themselves. And I thought that was just a fabulous thing to hear.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I'd say for the last 7 years, that's all I've been doing, is looking at myself in the mirror going, what else can you do? What else cut back on to stop this? You know, how much can you rip off? And I've pretty much down to the clothes on my back now. I can't really cut that back any more than starving the system of everything.
Yep, I think
that's what I choose to do. But you are the power now. You've got more power than you think. As a consumer, you have the power more than you think.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I've been following a pretty similar process here. And each step along the way opens up more steps that you can take. And, that's where the work is. The work is to be done by the individuals in the here and now. The situation we find ourselves in was birthed God knows how many thousands of years ago. But before it got like this, it was something else.
Yeah.
And as I say, you know, when push comes to shove, I'm a pan-dimensional light entity. Why the hell should I worry?
The best thing you can do is reach out your hand, and if someone grabs it and takes it, great. If they don't, let them go.
Exactly right. And if there's anything you can do to help, then don't hesitate, do it.
Yeah.
You know, because what goes out comes back.
Yeah.
Well, that's brilliant, Lee. I really thank you for stepping in. It's been a great chat. I've learned a lot. I've noted down a load of resources there. I'm really grateful to you for coming on the show. It's been brilliant speaking with you.
Anytime, man. It's the first time I've been on with you, really, so I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It certainly is. Where you're more than welcome on the Dr. Rock Radio Show. It's been fabulous.
Thanks, man.
Looks like it's gone down well in the chat shop, in the chat room. I mean, pretty much. There's been loads of, it's been moving so quickly, I haven't had a chance to kind of bring them all in. But as usual, the people at People's Internet Radio are brilliant. I really wouldn't want to be anywhere else. I think you're absolutely fabulous, though, all of you out there. And I'd really like to thank you as well for your participation. I'm aiming to be out by midnight, so we've got a... I'll say one last thanks to Lee, and I'm going to... There was more music lined up. Where's this one? Here we go. I'm going to play the Langan Band. It's called the Demented Set. This is a three-piece... They're a three-man band. There's a fiddle, a guitar, and a double bass, and this was recorded live at the Globe, and as I say, they are really as good as this when you see them live. They're absolutely stunning. So thanks very much to all of you for listening. Thanks to Lee for being here, and I'll be back with you next week when hopefully things will be a little bit more under control. In the meantime, here's a good night from the John Langan Band. I'll see you all soon. Thanks for being there, folks. It's really much appreciated.